This is the Fleet of Fiend, broadcasting from Pod Bay 2A, a mile above sea level, Intergalactic Furry Studios. We alter your locus coeruleus by warming your synapses with rejuvenative radio waves. This warms your brain to a tasty and toasty 365 degrees Fahrenheit to keep a sin flood of statism out of your head. Can you feel it? Is it working? Can you feel it?
See, I can feel it.
I think I can feel it.
And the Meow. Bad touch. And the Freedom Fiends is covered by a BIPCOT no government license. This allows reuse by anyone except governments. Learn more at BIPCOT.org. And welcome everybody to another weekend edition of the Freedom Fiends. I'm Lou, and I'm joined by a fellow that I haven't spoken to in quite a long time, Hugo. How are you doing, Hugo?
Hey there. Broadcasting from the sunny valley of Mexico City, where it's still summerish.
Excellent. And we have a special guest who's doing a return to the show. He was on the night before Thanksgiving, so I don't think all of our audience caught that because we're not on all the stations during the week. But we have Prof. CJ of the Dangerous History Podcast, and you can find him at profcj.org. He is the Renaissance man for the New Dark Age and the Guerrilla Scholar Warrior. Welcome back to the show, CJ.
That's right. I'm always out there with Jane Goodall studying the gorillas very carefully. And somehow, incidentally, every now and then I cover a little bit of history, too.
Yes, you do, and very interesting bits and pieces of history. And if you could just give a little description, your little infomercial for your podcast and what people can expect if they tune in.
Sure, yeah. My podcast is called The Dangerous History Podcast, and I've got a day job actually teaching history at a old school brick-and-mortar college, but I'm sort of like the Batman of history, so in the evenings, I like to put on a special costume, possibly with a cape, and then go out there and fight historical crimes, or at least point them out long after the fact. But I have a special superhuman power, which is wasn't good enough to get me into Professor X's Academy, but it is that I am able to get angry about things that have happened decades or even centuries or millennia ago. So
that's one good superpower.
It's a special power. It's rare, but yeah, it allows me to get just as angry about something Alexander Hamilton did or Sargon of Akkad did as I do about something that foot stinking liar socialist Barack Obama did last week.
Now, do you get angry about the actual crimes or the cover ups, meaning the whitewashed version of history?
Both. Both. It would be difficult for me to say which one bothers me more. But yeah, I just like putting out there in my podcast the sides of the story that the man would definitely not want you to hear.
And you do it quite well. And one of the things I meant to ask you about this the last time you were on, you do like car casting. You get in the silver bullet and do podcasts as you're driving.
Yeah, I do. I don't do them all the time, in part because it's got to be a topic there where I don't need a whole lot of notes. My commute to work is about 40 minutes. It's through a fairly rural area, so for the most part, traffic's not bad. But even so, you don't want to be talking about something where you need to be looking at a lot of notes and, you know, reading a lot of quotations and things. So every now and then, when there's a topic that I can just kind of talk off the cuff, then I will jump in the car either on the way to or from work and just, you know, jabber to my audience.
Nice. And what I like about those is, like you said, it's not like the hardcore history where you have to have all the different dates and all these little quotes and everything else. A lot of times it's just kind of rambling on about ideas or different theories and things like that. And I find that quite refreshing. It's not like the typical classroom environment where you're just going in there and you're getting, you know, name, date, rank, serial number, all this other stuff, and all right, memorize this and take the test. And there's actually a lot of thought behind it. And I really enjoyed a recent one that you did with Grain in the State, I believe it was called.
Yeah, and that was one I couldn't have done that one from the Silver Bullet. That was one where I was inside a building, sitting in a chair. But yeah, that one was pulling together a lot of stuff I'd been reading and thinking about for a long time, about kind of the links between the agricultural revolution of way back, you know, the change from genuine cavemen to sort of cavemen. And what kind of put it all together for me was our good friend Ben Stone, the Bad Quaker, recommended for me way back, like over a year ago, to check out the works of James C. Scott, and particularly his book, The Art of Not Being Governed. And when I went and read that, it kind of put it all together for me, the link between grain agriculture and the rise of oppressive states, to coin an oxymoron.
Yeah.
Oxymoron or redundancy?
Both.
Okay. So, Hugo, what have you been up to? I haven't spoken to you in, gosh, months.
Well, yeah, and I was thinking just now when CJ was saying was talking about the grain and tyranny that we have. You know, we have a lot of pyramids here in Mexico, and those aren't possible if you don't have an agrarian society where the priesthood is in cahoots with the warlords to do this large, impossible, and uneconomical project, you know? And it ran close to home.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Those are a lot of the same sorts of themes that I brought up in my my podcast that Lou was talking about, this link between political authority, religious authority, making slaves, build monuments to you, and all that stuff. I mean, it all kind of fits together.
Yes, yeah, that was the altar and throne one.
Yeah, yeah, that was a silver bullet one, the Alliance mm-hmm. of Throne and Altar.
Yeah, Prof. CJ and the Silver Bullet podcast.
Yeah.
Well, as our Venezuela correspondent, Hugo, because you were born and raised in Venezuela, and how old were you when you left there?
Yeah, that's true. I was 17 when I left Venezuela, so, you know, it's... I was almost, well, I would say I was an adult when I left the country. So I did live a lot of the craziness before it got even more crazy. And
okay, and mm-hmm. and you have met Hugo Chavez and shook his hand, right?
I did, and I kind of regret it. This was before I was enlightened. But at any point, I was never really excited about the guy, but I did go and I shook his hand, you know, and I took the picture. I didn't take the picture. My sister did take a picture, and it, you know, it was ruined for some, you know, providential reason. And this was before, I don't think it was even a digital camera. So, yeah, I did. And story of Venezuela is a bit different because there wasn't any advanced agrarian society with knowledge of astronomy and really big organized. It was more tribal, like small tribes. But yet we in Venezuela we had slavery, the good old chattel slavery with Africans brought in from ships from Africa, and we didn't have that in Mexico, which was partly a good thing. I was criticizing these days, the one of the ways of doing conquest, which was just murdering and butchering the native populations, which was different from what some of the Spaniards did, which was, you know, marry and have children, or not marry and have children, and blend that society together. It's a bit different. Yeah, I've been feeling that. With when I hear about when I'm listening to a history podcast, though I'm new to your show, CJ, I did listen a lot of the Bad Quaker ones, which are usually broadcasted on the Fiends too.
Yeah, well, if you like the Bad Quaker podcast, I'm pretty sure that you'll like Prof. CJ's. They're both very good, but strangely enough, everybody talks about the African slavery coming here to America, but the vast majority of the slaves that were imported from Africa, didn't they go to the Caribbean and South and Central America?
A lot more did than went to North America, for sure. I'm pretty sure the number one destination for African slaves brought to the New World by a pretty good margin was Brazil. Brazil was like practically just one giant sugar plantation for a lot of years.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. And, you know, many people don't understand that. Usually the slave traders usually just they didn't go long distance into the continent. They just bought slaves from another tribe who had enslaved people there, and they went into the continent and just got the slaves. As far as I know, though, you're the professor.
No, you're correct. And the Atlantic side was just one side. There was another branch of the slave trade that kind of went north across the Sahara and east, and that was supplying African slaves to the Islamic world too. So, just this giant global system of human misery.
Yeah, and
fun stuff.
Well, yeah, fun to talk about. Maybe just. Sure, well, I'm pretty sure it was terrible at the time.
Is it really nice that slavery has evolved from chains and whips to constitutions and cops, and it's just turned into tax slavery? So tax cattle on a tax farm. Much more civilized, right?
Well, yeah, you know,
it's a kinder, gentler machine gun hand.
Yeah. Yeah, free range slavery.
I'm usually torn with that concept because, you know, it is better, but at the same time, it kind of numbs the senses into recognizing the slavery.
Well, yeah, but if you look at different times in history and things that have been done to quell uprisings, one of the things that's been talked about many times, and CJ, you covered this, was stomping out literacy, because many of the slave revolts corresponded with few people learning to read. But we'll talk about that when we come back. More Freedom Fiends coming up.
Meow. Meow.
Hey, this is Nathan Explosion from Death Clock, and you're listening to Freedom Fiends on the radio. Worms.
Meow, meow.
Cock-a-doodle-doo.
Meow.
Meow, meow.
Wow.
Wow. Freedom Fiends down on the farm. We got all the animals here. Hey, this is Lou, and I'm joined by Hugo and our special guest today, Prof. CJ of the Dangerous History Podcast. And when we left the last segment, we were talking about slavery, modern slavery, and how it's made to not look like slavery. Are you guys familiar with Larkin Rose's video called The Jones Plantation?
Not that one.
I don't know if I've seen that one.
Tell us a bit more about it.
Well, the story...
No, ahead, tell us a bit more about it. I haven't seen that one.
Okay, well, it's animated, and it's about maybe 11 minutes long, and I'll send you a link. You can throw it in the show notes. But there's a slave owner, and he's having trouble with the slaves getting uppity, you know, getting that freedom bug. They cut the freedom from somebody, and now they want it for themselves. And this guy comes out, and... he says, okay, I'm going to show you how to control your slaves. And he goes out and he says, you're all free. And everybody's just looking at each other and says, now, you're all free. You're free to go. You know, we consider you free. But the people outside of this plantation might not consider you to be free. So if you would like to stay here to be safe, you can stay here. As a matter of fact... you'll have an equal share in everything that goes on. This will be our plantation. And they're like, hey, wow, we're free. It's our plantation. And of course, the guy that came out says, now, we understand that you should have some choices. So you can keep working for Mr. Jones here, or his cousin can be in charge. And they're like, Hey, wow, we get a choice on who the master is going to be. I mean, the leader,
sure,
because he's no longer a master. And so they vote for Mr. Jones's cousin, I believe it is. I might be getting some of the details wrong, but I'm getting the idea correct. So they have Mr. Jones's cousin, Mr. Smith, or whatever his name is. He takes over for a little while, and then they get a little bit sick and tired of him, and they have an opportunity to vote, and they vote Mr. Jones back in. And, you know, they're getting all this nonsense about how it's their plantation and you know, how they're all in it together and everything else. And you know, somebody decides that he's going to stand up and say, hey, you know, this sounds like they're blowing some smoke up our hindside. And, of course, the crowd shouts him down because, you know, it's their plantation and they have a choice and they'd never had it so good. And eventually he gets uppity and he winds up getting killed and people, you know, are like, you know, well, you should just obey the law. So, yeah, it's a very good representation of
modern America, I would say.
The USSA.
There is a way of controlling the recently freed slave in them, free slaves, and I would put that between quotation marks, freed. And that's pretty much how every country in the world works. That's how I would put it. And the idea, I don't know where that comes from. The idea of belonging to a tribe, I'm pretty sure it served a purpose early on. And there was some kind of evil genius that figured out he could muster that sentiment for enslaving people. Less painfully, right?
Yeah, it seems to me like a lot of the people at the top of the pyramid of power probably are legitimate psychopaths and sociopaths and other sorts of related things, but they couldn't do what they do if they weren't able to play upon the kind of sheep herd tribe mentality of the majority of regular people who are not really psychopaths, but unfortunately
this comes from Larkin Rose too,
the
idea, well, there's a book about it from Larkin Rose, which is the idea of authority, the idea that you should obey certain special people. And that's I would say the psychopaths know that, even though they don't believe in that, they can get other people to believe in that.
Yeah, it would be interesting if there was some sort of a magical, I don't know, radar gun type of thing that we could point at all the candidates that are in the field for American president for next
Not
year.
Not very useful, because I think
get like a psychopath report back.
All red.
That would be very interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I was thinking, you know, it might be interesting if like one or two of them wasn't 100%.
Well, when we come back from this trip to the market, we're going to put on our glasses, put in our chewing gum, and figure out who's a wizard. Or Frito Pete's coming right out.
Freedom Fiends.
This show survives on donations from fiends like you. We put that money back into our show and Liberty Outreach and donate most our ad space to Liberty organizations that make a difference. We're also a teaching hospital, educating the next generation of Liberty talkers on the skills needed to keep the radio flame of truth burning into the future. Put your money where your heart is and make a donation of any amount to the Freedom Fiends. Please go to freedomfiends.com and click on the spinning coin on any post.
Meow meow.
Woof woof.
Okay. Okay. Cuckoo, and the fiends are back. Freedom Fiends, Lusanda, and Professor CJ. And we were talking before about lizard people. Well, not really, but I think there could be some insight of what history tells about lizard people. I don't know, you guys, do you believe in lizard people?
Well, I think everybody knows that the lizard people thing is absolutely absurd. What we need to be concerned about, above all else, are the salamander people. The salamander people are as bad as the lizard people, but they have the added advantage of being amphibious.
But quite honestly, I think we really need to be afraid of the tortoise people, because you might judge them and think this.
Well, the tortoise.
No people. Response.
Mm-hmm.
you dropped out a minute there, Lou, at least on my end.
Yeah. Oh, mine too.
Oh, I was talking about the tortoise people, and you can question their abilities, but they can beat the hare in the race.
That's sure. True. A lot of people don't see them coming because they're slow and steady.
Yeah, but they're wiser than the other kinds of lizard.
That's true.
Well, yeah, it's really nonsense about the lizard people, but there could be a grain of truth or a grain of insight behind that. We're talking before about psychopaths, and I think everybody at some point do have an insight that there are some people who are not exactly like everybody else. I call them psychopaths, of course, and those people are attracted by power.
Yep.
Yes, they are. And who is it? I believe is Lord Acton says that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And I can't remember who threw in the part that power is magnetic to the corruptible.
Yeah, sure. What would you like, the decision to tell everybody else how to live and what color to paint their houses if you weren't evil to begin with?
Or what a person can eat or drink or put into their body.
Where they can move, and that's a topic that's been recently in the news, right? Some people somehow are liberty oriented, but yet they think that they should be able to tell others where they are allowed to move and where not.
Right, and of course, who's going to enforce all that? Big government.
Yeah. And they would criticize communist anarchists because they have to form a government. But, there's some... I would say that the devil is in the objective. There are some objectives that can only be achieved through tyranny. Absolute order. You cannot do that in liberty.
Yeah, the only way to get to Marxism is through Leninism and Stalinism. Or Maoism, for that matter.
Yeah. Or Chavezism.
Hey, but just think of the big giant jobs program that you'll have with digging all the mass graves. It's really funny because some prominent libertarians, and my voice is dripping with sarcasm here, have been making the idea out there that immigration is a violation of property rights. And the only way that is the case... because they say, well, are you gonna let an immigrant come move into your house? Well, no, but if I had an extra one, I'd probably be willing to rent it out to them. And when they start talking about, the whole property rights issue, it's as if the house that is not my own is actually my property, and I have a say in what's going to be done with it. And the only way that the whole of the United States is my property, or should I say our property, would be if all of the people own it in common and then it is managed by government. And I usually get this argument out of conservatives who are basically just right-wing socialists, but when I get it out of prominent libertarians, or dare I even say prominent anarcho-capitalists, I find it a little bit disheartening that they would criticize Marxism and socialism and communism, yet they make Marxist, socialist, communist arguments to support something that they like.
Sure, they do, and they do believe in representation of the whole populace by this band of thieves. That's the only way it can be done. I've been thinking about this problem for a couple of years now, because it's been growing. The whole I'm a libertarian, but I support tyranny thing has been growing for the last couple of years. I've been thinking about it, and sometimes they say what a foreigner or a refugee or someone from outside the country cannot do. But I was wondering, I'm wondering what they can do and who's going to determine that. And the only reason I've been able to get is the government. There's no way of determining what is allowed. Because some people want it, some people don't. And these people would think that the government can decide what's best. The problem is not who cannot, who are we allowed to prohibit, but who are we allowed to allow into the country. So that's a pickle they can't easily get out of.
Yeah, it is kind of very inconsistent. It's like if there's an anarchy meeting or something like that, and the old-time anarchists put on their fedoras and neck beards and go on down there, and the whole conversation is, who are you going to vote for this year? Yeah, there's a problem there. CJ, you were going to say something before I rambled?
Oh, yeah. Nothing real profound. I lost my train of thought, but it wasn't much of a train anyway. So
I was going to ask for your opinion on the historical perspective. Wasn't it the case that for most of history, immigration hasn't been restricted, effectively restricted, because it simply wasn't possible?
Yeah, I mean, I've not looked into all the details, but my understanding is that for most of the 19th century, immigration into the United States was very, very minimally controlled. There were politicians agitating. You know, there was the American Party back before the Civil War. That's the one that had the nickname the Know Nothing Party, because they were very secretive. They didn't pick their own nickname, because obviously the Know Nothing Party makes them sound like they're idiots. But sure, they were big on the anti-immigrant thing. And back then, of course, the big scary thing was those darned Irish Catholics are going to come in and ruin American civilization.
Because the Pope.
Yeah, right, exactly. They take orders from a Roman dictator. And then as each group came in, the last group got more upset about the next group. So, you know, when the Italians started coming in, the Irish were like, oh no, these Italians are coming in and everything. And so on and so on and so on down the way. And, you know, there was anti-Chinese hysteria out west for a long time. So, but it wasn't until the 20th century, I don't think, that the federal government really got heavily involved in all that stuff.
Yeah. The history of dissing on the new immigrants, the old immigrants were so proud to be here, and they looked down upon the newer folks. I bet it got to a point where the first person off the boat would just have absolute disdain and hatred for the last person off the same boat.
And one of the most interesting things is how sometimes it would be members of almost the same ethnic group that were just looking down on prior people from their same group.
Yeah.
I really, really have no idea what creates that sort of psychology or psychopathy.
Yeah, I think it's just the need of some people to feel like there's somebody that they're superior to. You know, so if you were an Irish immigrant that came here 20 years ago, you could look down on, there's not a lot of people you could look down on in American society back in like the 1840s or something. But the Paddy who just stepped off the boat 10 minutes ago, you could look down on him.
You can make fun of him and costumes and accent and all the things that you only a couple of years ago you were doing, right?
Sure, until some other ethnic group makes fun of him, and then suddenly you take his side. It's kind of weird like that.
Yeah, it happens every day. Yeah, sure.
It's how people are with their families.
Yeah, sure. I'm reminded of this, what happens in cities in the same way that happens in countries. When here in Mexico City, for example, there's some boroughs out there in the suburbs, and people were moving there when it was, you know, pretty much nothing. There was nothing there, and started building houses and living there. And suddenly, and they're doing businesses and doing shops and everything. And when they have a nice house and they paint it really, you know, white and pretty, they want to enact regulations, local regulations, to avoid prevent people from starting businesses there. Because, you know, we already here, and we were able to start a business or do something and become richer. And now that now we don't want anyone from downtown coming in and starting a business, because it's a nice part of town right now. That's the same thing.
Yeah, pretty much. Prior to the 20th century, and I want to say it happened after 1913, and no, I'm not going to put on my tinfoil hat and say, well, it's because of the Fed.
But it is.
I'm not saying it was the Fed, but it was a Fed.
Aliens.
Prior to Yeah, prior to the early 20th century, passports were pretty much unheard of, and the immigration was very lax. And going in, because this is December, if we think back to the Christmas truce during World War One, I believe that was 1915. Is that correct, CJ?
1914.
1914. Yeah.
Yeah.
So during the Christmas truce, you had Germans, I believe it was British, that were fighting against each other. Yeah.
Yeah, well, and also some French on the same side as the as the Brits.
Okay, well, there were numerous Christmas truces, but the one that's most popular is in the movie Joyeux Noël. But anyway, at one of these truces, they got together for, you know, and were trading and having dinner and all this other stuff. And a German soldier had been a chef over in London and had a restaurant there, and he was amazed to see some of his former customers on the British side, you know, when they went out for their little truce. And then unfortunately, because humans have this horrible flaw of being obedient to authority, after the truce was over, they started shooting at each other again.
Yes, they did. And it's incredible how much in that war, the British and the Germans demonized each other racially, considering that Germans and Brits are like almost the exact same ethnic group. I mean, where do you think the Anglo-Saxons came from, right? And the royal family actually had to change their official name because their name was the House of Saxe-Coburg-Gotha. Very, very German, because of course the British royal family was basically German. And that's when they changed it to the very bland and English-sounding House of Windsor. That way they could keep demonizing the Germans as horrible orc monsters.
Lizard people.
Yeah, well, yeah, pretty much.
The lizards were criticizing the orcs.
Only thing worse than a lizard is a German lizard.
Oh,
you're
man.
Listening to the Freedom
words.
Fiends, an invigorating more alternative to those
we'll be
other
back.
Shows.
Wake up and smell the freedom. One of the easiest things you can do to help Liberty is to torrent Freedom Fiends episodes to help keep them drone-proof. You can set up your home computer to download and share Freedom Fiends archives over BitTorrent. You can even set up scheduling so it only shares while you're asleep or at work. Put your unused computing power to work and help keep the Freedom Fiends around well into the future. Simply go to freedomfiends.com and click on the Torrent Club link and learn how to torrent and share Freedom Fiends archives.
Meow, 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 meow. Meow.
Freedom Fiends. Hey, this is Lou, and I'm back with Hugo and Prof. CJ. And I got a question for you, CJ. This was a topic of discussion on the Fiends a long time ago, and I meant to ask you this the last time you were on, but when did people start saying, if only we could get back to the Constitution? When did that start? What's your thoughts on that?
Wow. I think probably the 1790s at the latest. Probably you could find some of that going on when George Washington was still in the White House and Hamilton was doing his thing over at Treasury. And Jefferson and a few other people were already starting to complain that the federal government is not following its supposed script.
Okay, and probably as the Bill of Rights was drying, it may have started there. And matter of fact, before the Bill of Rights was drying, I'm pretty sure that the Federalists were like, okay, now how do we start violating this?
Yeah, definitely Hamilton, Robert Morris, George Washington, those sorts of fellows were certainly thinking some of those things.
Yeah, because I mean, they did look at the Bill of Rights as a to-do list, meaning things to take care of. But I'm gonna play devil's advocate and disagree with you a bit. I would say that it was probably at least 20 years after the ratification of the Constitution.
20 years, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because As we all know, the Constitution was not popular when it was first introduced and when it was first ratified. And it usually takes about a generation for people to forget these things, and all of a sudden it starts becoming normalized. So I mean, it could have been about 10 years, but just to be safe, I'm going to say about 20. Because if you look at the pushback against the Constitution from the common folks, as you know, Rhode Island was the last to be captured, I mean, to join the Union. And when it went to a vote of the general voting public, it was soundly rejected. I believe it was 11-1, something like that. And that was the only place that was put to a vote. So I imagine those who had just fought a war to get away from an overbearing central government were really not that interested in falling under the yoke of a new overbearing central government.
Yeah, so you know, what's interesting is when you look at the like the academic literature on the topic, every historian who's an expert on that sort of issue in that time period, even when they're hardcore statists, will admit that if the Constitution went up for a, you know, countrywide plebiscite, it would have gone down in flames.
So it makes you wonder if it was such a good thing after all.
Of course it was. That's unquestionable dogma.
Wasn't
James Madison walked up Mount Sinai and talked to a burning bush who gave him some rocks on which were inscribed United States Constitution.
Wasn't
we the people?
Yeah, we the, well, we, you the people.
Go ahead, Hugo.
There's a book by Murray Rothbard, which we probably have read, which is Conceived in Liberty. And some of the points he raises there is that before the Constitution was ratified, and well, long after that, the United States lived in what would be described today as a state of anarchy. You mean everybody could do their thing, and government wouldn't meddle. That's why people were moving into the frontier of the West or the East, depending on where you were starting from, running away from government. Is that would you say that it was that way, Prof. CJ?
I'd say that's overstating it a bit, but it certainly depended on where you were. I mean, you're correct that out in the more frontier areas, it was a lot more wide open, and that's kind of the oftentimes neglected version of why did people keep streaming out to the Western frontier throughout American history and keep pushing the frontier out. You know, only part of it was to find gold or land or whatever. A big part of it was just like to get away from the state. And unfortunately, the further west they went, the more the state just sort of followed them.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, probably in big cities, it was already feeling like there's too much government, right?
Yeah, there seems to be something about dense population and big government that they kind of go together pretty well a lot of the time. What's your experience, Hugo, in Mexico City? It's like, what, the biggest or second biggest city in the world?
Yeah, it is exactly that. And, well, I can talk a little bit more about that when we come back from the market. And, yeah, meow, meow, meow. I'll talk about Mexico.
Meow.
Coming back. Woof, woof. Meow!
Hey, this is Squiscar Squig Elves from Death Clocks, and you are listening to the Freedoms Fiends on the, you know, the radios. And I guess I says worms now, so there you go.
Tired of those old Freedom Fiends buttons? Well, the Freedom Fiends have new button designs.
As always, it's only $10 for 10 buttons, and you'll get these nifty designs. Buy sheep, for sheep, on sheep.
State speech is hate speech.
Two designs for Guns and Weed, the Road to Freedom.
Three designs for Fiend Phone.
Pipcot No Gov.
A Freedom Fiends Worms button.
And ask me about my worms.
Go to freedomfiends.com and click on the link at the top that says Buttons.
And now they're bigger buttons.
They used to be 1¼ inch. Now they're 1¾ inch. Dan, they're bigger buttons.
What does freedom mean? Tune in to LRN.FM to find out. LRN.FM is the Liberty Radio Network, a collection of live talk radio and podcasts, all coming from a principled pro-liberty perspective. LRN.FM show hosts aren't left, right, or conspiracy kooks. You can tune in 24/7 to LRN.FM via your phone, computer, satellite, and more. Listen free anytime at LRN.FM. That's LRN.FM.
Estos son los Freedom Fiends, transmitiendo desde el cañón iónico de baja órbita del campo de reeducación libertario en la cima de la plaza financiera bestial en el satélite artificial Deep Earth 2017 en la región de Alpha Centauri. This is Hugo from Mexico with the Freedom Fiends in hour two, and with me are Lucander Fiend and Professor CJ. How are you doing, guys?
Estoy muy bien. Hola, mis amigos. Y bienvenido.
That's great. That's some really good Spanish of you right there. Yeah, welcome, everybody. And we were leaving on a note, well, on an international note, right, Professor CJ? We're talking about Mexico and big cities.
Yeah, giant metropolises.
That's true, and they seem to have a tendency to become tyrannies or to love big government, right? Like, you know, New York and D.C. and what other places do you know where tyranny reigns that are big cities there in the U.S.? I don't know that many cities in the U.S.
Chicago's pretty bad.
Every place with a government.
Well, pretty much every place, so.
Because I find big government to be a redundancy. Government is always big as it's capable of being. Yeah, or it's always as big as it dares to be at the time.
Yes. So it's never voluntarily smaller than it can possibly be, right?
Well, except for when those founding fathers said, look, we have to have this small, tiny government, you know, and we're going to protect liberty. Oh, by the way, we're going to add all these new powers to this centralized government for the purposes of protecting liberty. You know, like unlimited taxation, unlimited national debt, unlimited necessary and proper to create a Leviathan state, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah, the blueprint for
the general welfare and interstate commerce.
Yeah.
Yeah. Unlimited interference with commerce.
Yeah, and we have that too here in Mexico, and also in Venezuela and some other Latin American countries. They have constitutions that give the citizen a lot of rights in on paper, at least, you know, right to health and the right to life and to travel and to usually never the right to own things, because, you know, that would be just crazy for them to give you the right to own things unconditionally, but.
Perdóname, por favor, señor. Constitutions don't give rights.
Yeah.
Constitutions are, they might be magic pieces of parchment, but those rights are inherent in our humanity, or, if you are a theist, they are bestowed upon us by our Creator as a virtue of our humanity. Our rights exist because we exist.
Well, yeah. Yeah, they are, and the some constitutions in Latin America have changed to recognize this, that, you know, we recognize rights instead of creating those rights. But, you know, most people think what would happen to those rights were not for the constitution, or, you know, you can substitute the Venezuelan, Peruvian constitution, any of those, because they are the same tool, just with a different
North Korea.
Yeah, if you read the North Korean Constitution, they have a bunch of rights there, right?
Yes, Chapter 5, Article 67 and 68 are almost a mirror image of the First Amendment from the U.S. Constitution. Article 67 talks about freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom to assemble and demonstrate, and then also Article 68 talks about freedom of religion.
Okay, so. You've just sold me. I'm moving to North Korea now. With parchment like that, you can't go wrong.
Well, you know what? It is the American conservative paradise because they have strong border security, lots of military, no Mexicans or Muslims.
That's right.
Yeah.
What more could you ask for?
Support their troops.
Yes. Now that you mention it, I've never heard a Mexican here say I should be moving to the land of cheap rice, North Korea. Yeah. should tell you something. Yeah. So, right here in Mexico City, for example, we have been they did a very tiny reduction in government. They took away one tax for cars, but they replaced it immediately with a lot of speed cameras. So we're getting tickets everywhere for going over, and I'm gonna do the conversion in a minute. They're 85 kilometers per hour, so I'm gonna do the conversion right now. But yeah, you know, I was going
it's
really
about 53.
Slow. About 53, yeah. Yeah, so yeah, we're getting tickets for going over 53 in, you know, in the so-called fast ways in the city. And we're getting, the police getting more power, and we already have a lot of taxes, and we already have nationalized water service and electricity. So yeah, people love the big governments we're here. And you know, the thing that baffles me the most is people are they want to be good. People really want to be good, but they confuse being good with obeying. And if the government starts a biking program, so, because you know the city is crowded with cars, people will want to be good, and we want to follow the government initiative, not knowing that it is basically enforced by violence. And they give free bikes here. Well, not free bikes. You can use the free bikes. They're almost free, about $20 a year for a membership. And now people are getting run over by cars.
What I think, and it's more of a hope than a think, but I do think this. It's not that people want to be obedient to government, because a law-abiding citizen is just an obedient slave. I think people want to get along with others and be cooperative. I don't know, maybe that's just wishful thinking on my part. Maybe, you know, I should just go tend the unicorn ranch out in the backyard. I don't know, but I think that's the real motivation. And something else, you mentioned a reduction in government in Mexico. And when I heard that, I thought you were going to say that they're executing fewer lefty students now than they were last year.
It's been known all over the world, that thing with the students in Ayotzinapa, which is something that happened a year ago, and some students got killed. And people have been saying it's a narco thing or it's a government thing. I would say that if the government gives itself the ability or the responsibility to care for your life, then when you die, it's their fault. It's conservative people here have been talking and saying, you know, you can't ask the government for everything. And yet, if the government controls everything, how is it not their responsibility?
Well, you can't really expect them to protect you, can
I know
you?
That, and I know that, but many people don't. So, yeah, you cannot expect protection.
You can't have a cop on every corner, but you can have a traffic light camera or a speeding camera.
Yeah, and they cannot really. Imagine you're rushing to the hospital with some loved one in the car. If that were a cop, you could possibly, you know, tell them and they would escort you to the hospital. That used to happen here in Mexico. But with a camera, what can you do? You know, just rush to the hospital and then pay the price of rushing to the hospital. It doesn't know about anything, about any reasons or about any situations. You can always put a camera there. I was tempted to take one of those tickets to court, but it turns out you have to pay them and then try and take them to court, which I don't know what the purpose is. Yeah, you have to pay them.
That sounds like a really small version of asset forfeiture.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
It is. You have to, because when you read the ticket, it is phrased as though it were being written by the cop that gave you the ticket. And they give the name, was patrolling in this on this corner that day, and we all know there was nobody there. And if you would be able to take the ticket to court, you could say, you know, bring the police, have the policeman present himself or the cop present himself or herself to court and, you know, testify I was there, at least, because they weren't there. But, you know, life's too short, as you were saying before.
And the best thing is, if you have an actual cop and you get them into court, you've got them off the streets. So you've actually protected our people. Now, here in America, when you get a speeding ticket, unlike Mexico, you can negotiate a discounted warning fee. Here, you get the ticket, so you get stopped and you lose, I don't know, 20, 30 minutes of your time. And then you have to go to a separate building and either give them the shakedown money or you have to set a date to go back and talk to a judge, and you know the cop will show up, which is a good thing because you get them off the streets. And you know, in most cases, the cop's going to side with the judge because, well, and the court gets a chunk of the money. And if you don't like it, you can go to a trial. And that is probably the least efficient armed robbery that I have ever seen. And it's, oh my God. A proper street thug will have you on your way in 30 seconds.
Yeah.
They'll take your wallet. That you call him your honor.
Yeah. And you know what? He'll probably tell you, hey, next time, put a little something in your sock because I don't usually look there. But then he's going to start looking there. I don't know. But, you know, you illustrated it really good with reduction in government because you have a reduction in one spot, but it inflates another. So I know visual humor isn't good for radio, but picture a balloon, like a long balloon that's used for making balloon animals, and you squeeze one end, and you call that shrinking government. But the air has to go somewhere, and when you look at the other end that's twice the size that it was before, that's where it went to. So, yeah, that's shrinking government.
And that's a way
pretty much what happened under Ronald Reagan was, you know, cut a few things over here and increase a few things over there.
Some people here were calling him almost a libertarian because, you know, because they don't know anything, probably. I don't know. They have this dream that he, you know, he opposed Soviet Russia, but, you know, Hitler also opposed Soviet Russia.
Good point. Well, if you judge a politician by their words instead of their actions and their track record, you're going to get a lot of really great people. If you judge them the other way around, you're going to get a lot of people that most people would call for the execution of.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. And that's true in every country, I would say. There's really not a lot of difference. And, you know, people, once a guy who was a refugee, he was in New York, and he was a refugee here in Mexico because he'd been in the Foreign Legion, and he'd seen combat and everything. He told me, you know, talking about Palestine and Israel, you know, I recognize that everybody pretty much want the same things. And everybody, you know, people want to have a job, people want to have a family, people want to have some free time to do what they like. And if you start thinking that's the way people are, the whole problem becomes, you know, much smaller. That's at least what I think.
And we'll be back.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends. So much truth, it hurts. Gun Training with the Non-Aggression Principle, Volume 1. Basic Handgun and Rifle with Jared Waltz.
First rule of being alive is you own yourself.
A groundbreaking approach to firearms and self-defense training. Beautifully filmed and easy to understand instructions make this one a must-have. Gun Training with the Non-Aggression Principle, Volume 1. New DVD from Michael W. Dean, available on Amazon.
Your house is your property.
Yow! Woof, woof. So get them on the Domino Head. This is the Freedom Fiends International version. I got a question for you, Hugo. Being that you are our foreign resident of Venezuela correspondent, recently in the elections, the Maduro regime, or at least his party, suffered some major losses. And I'm still not sure if the opposition, if you want to call it that, has picked up their supermajority. But what do you think is going to be the result of these election results in Venezuela, where the hardcore socialist regime has basically been trounced and has been put in with probably a softcore socialist regime?
Well, actually, I'll tell you, I got surprised by the results. I never thought, I was thinking that the elections were so rigged that this could never happen. And they are rigged, but it did happen. Right now, the opposition has already gotten their supermajority, and they can do a lot of things, including calling for the destitution of the president, which is Maduro. And
calling for the what?
The destitution of Maduro, calling for his removal, impeachment. They have to do a referendum or a plebiscite process, but they can call it without the citizenship having to, you know, gather signatures or anything like that.
Okay, so, I thought you said execution.
No. Destitution, yeah. No, not execution. I don't think that's possible. But yeah, you never know. I'm always reminded by Nicolas Maduro of Nicolas Ceausescu, or however you pronounce it. He was executed by the military in, was it Romania or was...
Romania.
Romania, right? So they do have the supermajority, and they could abolish any kind of laws they wanted, at least the ones on the... At least if the executive power stuck to the legality of the Constitution, we coming back to the Constitution. But I don't think they're going to... I don't think they will. I think they will be rather soft on Maduro, because as you were saying before, it's not a real opposition. They want the same things. They want government programs and price controls, and they want to not be hungry while doing that.
So are you saying that the whole voting harder thing isn't really going to bring a whole lot of hope and change to them?
Well, I don't mean to be pessimistic, but yeah, that's what I think. Yeah, that's what I think. You can vote harder and you can elect different politicians. And we have to, you know, I don't want to sound like a fanatic, because I don't think I am. And I do recognize differences. It's not the same thing being in North Korea than being in Venezuela, being in Cuba, than being in France or the United States. It's very different. And we should try to live as possibly as comfortable as we can, as free as we can, which I think they go hand in hand. But I don't think there's a silver bullet for that.
Now, Hugo Chavez was actually quite popular before his death, right?
He was. He was a very charismatic leader, which sounds like a very bad thing in my mind. Whenever everybody says, you know, he's so charismatic, all my alarms go off. And
yeah, the same thing was said about Ted Bundy, but continue.
Yeah, sure. It takes a long time to destroy the economy of a country. It took him more than 10 years. So yes, you can be charismatic and you can blame the empire. That's how he calls the United States, which is kind of fun because we could do that. The United States government, I mean. Libertarians
okay,
sometimes.
So I agree with Chavez on something.
Yeah, you got to agree with Chavez on regarding something. And he calls the United States government the empire, and he blames the U.S. government for everything, for every bit of misery that he's caused. So it takes a long time. So fortunately for himself, he died before he could see the wreck in the economy. And right now, there are people who don't know what's going on are blaming the whole crisis on Maduro, which is just, you know, the next in line. They should know if you do price and wage controls and you inflate the money supply endlessly, you're going to get a crisis. It doesn't matter whether you're charismatic or not.
Do you think the voters see the folly of this idea?
I don't think they do, because they think they can vote harder, really. And people went massively to the polls. And there's some change.
I think what's going to happen is they're going to back off for a little while, and then they're going to say, well, we still like socialism, and if we could get the right people in charge, and if we could get back to the Communist Manifesto.
You're listening to the Freedom Theme.
This will be successful.
And I'm beaming these words into your cerebellum.
Are you sick of peaceful people being locked away for victimless crimes? Instead of trying to get out of jury duty, consider taking it so you can do the right thing. A single juror with a conscience can send someone home to their family instead of to a jail cell. If there's no victim, how can there be a crime? And if the judge or prosecutor are keeping you in the dark, what are they trying to hide? You can vote your conscience instead of being a pawn of the state. For more information, Google jury nullification or check out the Fully Informed Jury Association at fija.org.
Meow, meow.
During the break, we were talking about people being erased from Soviet history. And interestingly enough, the way of editing high school textbooks back in the Soviet Union, even going into the 80s, was kids would take black magic marker. And I found out the hard way in college that that's not the best way to highlight your notes in the textbook. They would take black magic marker and cross people's names out. And they would actually change the stuff. So the teacher would go up to the head of the class and say, okay, you know, we have to edit these textbooks or change history, whatever. And they'd cross people out and they'd add, you know, change things around. And that's how it was done. So, yeah, real interesting. Could you imagine doing that in your classroom, CJ?
Well, all I can say is I'm glad there are no political interventions into history to make it serve any particular stories in America.
Well, no magic markers, but we have e-books right now.
Oh wow, that could be edited just by changing some HTML, so somebody could become an unperson very quickly.
Yeah, could you imagine how much the Soviets could have done if they had had Photoshop and things like that? So much easier.
Yeah, it would have been so much easier to take people out of pictures. You know, like they never existed.
Yeah, and move people around, you know, put one guy's head on another guy's body to fit the story of the day. I mean, same thing like when you read 1984, you know, the low-tech analog stuff they're doing there. It's hilarious compared to what you can do with a few clicks today.
Imagine if you could do a surveillance state with, you know, the technology like the Stasi in Eastern Germany. Just imagine. Fantasize about it, because it's obviously not happening.
Yeah, that would be crazy.
Yeah,
yeah. If the East German Stasi had the technology, that would have been absolutely horrible. It would have looked, I don't know, like the Department of Homeland Security today.
Yeah, the NSA. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
No such agency.
So, right.
I started watching a movie. You know, since we've been talking about socialism. Well, actually, it's a series, and it's Amazon Prime Original. It's called The Man in the High Castle. And we're not going to give any big, giant spoilers here, so you don't have to worry about a spoiler alert or trigger warning or anything like that. And the idea of the show, it's a 10-part series, and I have to say that I really enjoyed it. It's based upon a novel by Philip K. Dick, and I have not read the novel, so I don't know how close it is, because there's some novels out there where the only thing the movie and novel have in common is, I don't know, the name of a couple characters and that's it. Now, some of the Tom Clancy books are like that. But what happens in The Man in the High Castle is it's what if the Axis powers had won World War II? And what you have is the USSA is divided into two sections. West of the Rocky Mountains, you have the Japanese taking control, and it's I believe the Pacific States or Japanese Pacific States, something like that. East of the Rockies, you have the New Reich. I can't remember exactly what that's called, but that's controlled by the Germans. And the Rocky Mountains themselves appear to be like a little Ancapistan neutral zone, where nobody really has any control there. And I don't know if the Germans would have their incursions in there for resources or if the Japanese would, but it pretty much seemed like there was nothing there. Well, there were people there, but nobody was claiming the land as for one country or another. And CJ, you've seen the pilot episode of it.
Yeah, that's all that I've seen so far.
Yeah, and did I mention that it takes place in, I think, 1962?
You mention it now.
Okay. All right, so that would basically be, about 17 years after World War II ended, or as we know it ended?
Yeah, and wasn't the whole premise that the Germans got the A-bomb first, and that's how they were able to win?
Yes, yes, and they dropped the bomb on Mortar on the Potomac. So, but what's really interesting is, of course, you have the resistance, a small little insurgency, but they're not like the typical resistance or insurgency to where they're stockpiling arms and going on missions and killing Nazi soldiers, you know, like Solzhenitsyn said that they should do. They're kind of trying to wake people up, because the one thing that really kind of shocked me is that, and I'm going by history as we know it, that there was such a hatred for the Japanese and the Germans from World War II, and that there are so many people that just basically turn into bootlicking Tories. It's really horrible.
I already want to watch it from your telling of the story.
Yeah, whose boots are you talking about, like that they lick the boots of the German and Japanese
of the occupiers? Yeah, because like over in the German area, and I believe it shows like New York City, you have American SS officers. One of the guys, I believe a Obergruppenführer, which is like a group leader, or maybe like a division commander, so to speak.
Sounds like a cab driver.
The New York City area. Yeah. Well, that too. He's in charge of the SS. And of course, you know, they never stop looking for dissidents and infiltrators and all this other stuff. And everybody's always sending out spies, trying to spy on everybody and find potential infiltrators and everything. So they're running their operations. And of course, the Germans are trying to work against the Japanese a little bit. The Japanese are working against the Germans, and even though they have a truce. So it's kind of like it is today. But some of the things I noticed in there, for example, there's one scene, this is not a real big spoiler. A guy is on the side of the road and a cop, you know, is helping him change the tire, and all of a sudden he's got ash falling on it. They got ash falling on them from the sky, and the young guy says, "Hey, what's that?" And the cop says, "Oh, that's probably just the hospital. It's Tuesday. Yeah, that's when they get rid of the cripples and the sick and elderly and all this other stuff." So the whole eugenics thing never really stopped, but that was also going on here in America.
Yes, yes, and in some places, some other places, I was postulating the same thing, that what if the Nazis and the fascists had won World War II, and some people do we'd all be speaking German now, right? And I'm thinking more a place like Argentina. Fascism is really not very economically, you know, effective. Once you're out of war, then with the controls, you become a mediocre community, like mediocre economy like Argentina, you know. So fascism doesn't work in peace. And I thought that.
And doesn't Argentina destroy their currency every 10 years, whether they need to or not?
Yeah. Yeah, they do. Well, it is true. It is true. Right now, I was reading some posts by people in Argentina that tariffs were so high that it was better for you to travel to New York and buy, you know, a laptop there and then bring it back than buying it after all the taxes and tariffs in Argentina. So, yeah.
Wow.
It's a very interesting thought experiment to think what would have happened. And you see the politicians in those times in the early, I don't know, 1930s. And there was one in Argentina, which was the you know, similar to FDR, and which was similar to Hitler, and which was similar to Mussolini in pretty much every public policy. Only the one, you know, only because of the Jew thing, and the racial cleansing thing, one got the name Nazism and became really, really, I don't know how I would say, vilified, which rightly so. But the other kind of policies were all the same in both sides of the Atlantic. There was fascism in America, in North America, South America, Europe, and in Japan too. Would you say that?
Yeah, fascism is one of those tricky things because it kind of like those chameleon salamander lizard people we mentioned before, fascism kind of like adapts itself to the country, to the host country. You know, it sort of morphs into, it uses the kind of mythology and the language and the imagery and all that of a country's history in order to kind of, you know, appeal to the people there. And so I think George Carlin was probably right when he said, when fascism comes to America, it's not going to be jackboots and swastikas. It's going to be smiley faces and Nike running shoes.
When it comes,
or,
of course.
Or wrapped in a flag carrying a crucifix.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Sure,
yeah.
There was.
Now, you've done.
Go ahead.
Excuse me. You've done a couple of shows, CJ, on fascism. One of them was titled Fun with Fascism. And I can't remember the title of the other, but could you give us a really good, solid definition of fascism?
That's actually really hard. And it's something that political scientists and historians still argue about. It's one of those things where you can kind of list a bunch of characteristics and say, well, if a government has most of those, it's fascist. But some of the things that would characterize fascism would be militarism, a large government that does a lot of welfare and warfare type stuff, a government that finances a lot of big spending projects with debt and inflation, a government that monitors, you know, speech and communications. And when it comes into its fully formed epitome, it's a one-party authoritarian state usually headed by a charismatic ruler. Now, of course, some countries have figured out that a better thing to do is to have, you know, a couple of parties. That way, you know, people get the illusion of being able to go back and forth from one flavor to the other.
Excuse me, CJ. I asked you for a definition of fascism. I didn't ask you to define the United States of America.
Duh.
Now, Mussolini had said that fascism is the marriage of corporation and state. How would you compare that to mercantilism of, let's say, the 1700s?
It's an extension and a modernization of mercantilism, honestly. It's based on the same kinds of basic premises.
It will be, okay.
With the mercantilism, that's a lot of protectionism. The corporations are, well, we'll finish this up when we come back from this trip to the market.
Listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and some of his weird friends. And yes, we're broadcasting this into space.
Are you tired of your taxes funding endless occupations around the world? Antiwar.com is run by people who understand that wars abroad become wars at home, wars on our freedoms. Antiwar.com is dedicated to bringing you the latest in news, views, interviews, and reviews from the top movers and shakers in the anti-occupation movement. Antiwar.com has it all, from thorough foreign policy analysis to interviews with whistleblowers who used to run the military-industrial complex. Anti-war, pro-free market. That's antiwar.com.
Meow. Wow.
Woof.
Squawk, squawk, squawk.
All right, this is the Freedom Fiends, and this is our final segment. I want to go back to what we were talking about before the break. My kind of understanding or interpretation of mercantilism, particularly the 1700s and British mercantilism, would be that it was a protectionism of the politically connected interests, and it seems like the corporations were a little bit more controlling of the government, whereas if you look at Mussolini's type of fascism, it's kind of the same thing, but the government will just go and nationalize everything if they need to. So it seems like it's more lopsided in the favor of the government in that case. Would you say that's fair, or am I all wet?
Yeah, I think that's an accurate way to put it. And then it raises the question of, if you're looking at the modern-day U.S. government, who's in the driver's seat, right? Is it, you know, some people say it's the corporations using the state. Other people say it's the state, you know, manipulating the corporations. I don't know. What do you think?
That's a good question. Because I mean, typically, you know, people complain about politicians selling favors, or, well, what they really say is they're buying off our government, those evil corporations, and they're completely ignoring that corporations, lobbyists, and the politically connected would be completely powerless and irrelevant if politicians didn't have favors to sell in the first place. And you could thank the Founding Fathers for their Interfering with Commerce Act, because, you know, those regulations haven't been implemented to protect the consumer. They've been implemented to protect the politically connected.
Yeah.
Now, it is possible that instead of the lobbyists, you know, going and buying off the politicians are just shaking down the lobbyists saying, okay, there's going to be a regulation coming out, and for the right price, you can have a say in it. And that's always a possibility, too.
Yeah, I remember reading somewhere a while back in an article, and I can't recall for the life of me where it was, but that when the U.S. government was less directly involved in intervening in the economy, corporations used to spend a lot more money on actual R&D for products. And then as the government has gotten ever increasingly involved in meddling in the economy, it's switched, and now major corporations typically spend way more money on lobbying than they do on R&D for their products. So might explain a few things.
So does that mean that all that lobbying money means that we're going to get, oh, I don't know, lower quality products, and the technology would not advance as quickly as it would without government intervening?
Yeah, it's hard to imagine, but I think that might actually be a possibility.
Wow. And that last time that people were putting more money into R&D instead of lobbying government, when was that, 1788?
Somewhere around there, maybe a little bit later, but yeah.
Well, what's really interesting, if you hear about all the different IP lawsuits and enforcement, a lot of these tech companies are actually spending more money on patent trolling than they are on actually, you know, doing R&D also.
Yeah, which is really just another form of mercantilism.
Mm-hmm.
That would be in the worst of cases. Well, actually, in the best of cases, you would be spending a lot of money and time and lawyers into defending yourself from patent trolls. Even if you're not in the business of trolling other companies with patents, you have to spend the money anyway in defense.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. That would.
So, yeah. Given the current system.
Yeah, I guess the question would be is, how do you see this working out, and what is the solution for when it does work out the way that I think you're going to answer?
There is no hope. Just have a good laugh while the Titanic sinks beneath the waves.
Hugo?
Well, keep playing.
Any
keep,
thoughts?
Keep playing the string quartet. As the water is coming, rushing in, probably. I don't know. Just be clear. That's my advice. You know, it comes your way, but you don't have to believe it. You can be clear and maybe steer the ship here and there your own way.
Yeah, and have a good laugh at the bad guy's expense.
And floating harder is not going to help.
No.
All right, thanks,
it
Hugo.
It might be a longer leash.
It's a pleasure to talk to you again, Hugo, and thank you, CJ, for coming on again. You can find CJ at profcj.org or Google the Dangerous History Podcast. And for more Freedom Fiends, go to freedomfiends.com.
And I say worms. Great to be with you guys.
Adios, mi amigo.
Adios. Live free.